Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this hour. Thank you for listening in. We have a very full show today, as usual. Lots of talk about stuff, including news, law, politics, history, blizzards, and winter fires. I may even throw in a squirrel if we have time. But first, here's Dennis Hart with local news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. Take it away, Mr. Hart.
Thanks very much. And as always, it's good to be here with you on this Friday. Let's start where we usually do, with a look back at what made news last Saturday. And what made news was a report that Ames housing just might be more affordable than some studies show, including the study by HomeArea.com that indicated Ames is one of the least affordable Iowa cities with populations of 60,000 or more. That study based its findings on the median income of each individual in a city, but Iowa State University economics professor Peter Arazum said because students with little or no income make up half the population of Ames, a better indicator would be median family income. Using that, Arazum said, would make Ames much more affordable in studies. Also last Saturday, a report about city council budget meetings held to fine-tune the city's proposed $250 million budget for the next fiscal year. Among the highlights, Parks and Recreation will see a nearly 7% increase in general fund support. The Furman Aquatic Center will see a 50-cent increase on daily admission and a 3% hike on season passes. And there was word that the construction of the Miracle Field and all-inclusive playground in Ines Grove Park could start this summer. In the public safety category, law enforcement will increase its presence in the Ames School District with the addition of a second school resource officer. Also last Saturday, a report on the campaign stop made by Democratic presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg last Friday. The mayor of South Bend, Indiana, showed up at Cafe Diem, making Ames the first city he's visited since he announced he's running for the Oval Office. He told the crowd there that, in his words, it's a moment of profound realignment in American politics, a moment calling for new voices and bold ideas. And one more note from last Saturday, word that the Hillside Waterwise Garden at Ryman Gardens in Ames will attract national attention when it's featured in the U.S. Botanic Garden's new exhibit in Washington, D.C. this coming April. The Waterwise Garden will be one of 21 gardens nationwide in an exhibit called Celebrating New American Gardens. The Ryman Gardens creation is not typical of most gardens because its planting style relies on gravel for its upper mulching. That gravel will not decompose for the life of a human-made garden. On Sunday, word that the so-called Emily's Law would be brought to an Iowa House subcommittee at the state capitol this week. Emily's Law is named after Emily Jacobs, an 18-year-old Iowa State University freshman who was struck and killed by a Cyride bus at Lincoln Way and Ash Avenue as she walked to classes in 2015. The bus driver eventually pleaded guilty to a simple misdemeanor for failing to report an accident. He received a 30-day jail sentence and a $100 fine. Emily's Law stipulates that a person operating a motor vehicle who leaves the scene of an accident without knowing if that accident resulted in the injury, serious injury, or death of another person must give notice of the accident to Iowa law enforcement immediately after the person finds out what happened. Also Sunday, word that Sleepy Hollow Park, which is east of Ada Hayden Park, will soon have 15 additional acres added to it once fundraising is complete. The Iowa National Heritage Foundation, the Story County Conservation Board, and the Story County Chapter of Pheasants Forever are all part of the expansion project, which started when the previous owner of the land offered it for sale. There was also a story about an Iowa State University professor who has spent the past few years working at the Iowa Lakeside Laboratory. Lori Biederman is helping catalog thousands of different organisms that were found in a collection of records at the lab, which is near West Okoboji Lake in Milford. There was also word about an Ames woman who is battling cancer, and with the limited time she has left, is trying to give something back to the community. Her name is Teresa Braun. She's an advocate for animal rights, and she's donating beds to the Ames Animal Shelter. And, of course, last Sunday saw stories about Iowa State's men's and women's basketball teams, both of which were in action on Saturday. The men's team lost to TCU 92-83. The women's team defeated West Virginia 77-61. Tuesday brought word that the Ames City Council was going to consider whether to sponsor an Iowa Economic Development Authority application for financial assistance of $300,000 on behalf of an Ames-based software company for an expansion project that could create 300 jobs. One-third of those jobs would pay $100,000 a year or more. Veertech Software opened 2 years ago in the Iowa State University Research Park. It now employs 65 people. The company wants to build and lease a 60,000-square-foot facility in the research park and add 300 workers. The council did vote unanimously to endorse that application. Also Tuesday, a story about the tough decisions school superintendents have to face in Iowa when the snow flies. Superintendents have to make the call on whether to cancel classes by 6 a.m., and they use a variety of factors to make their decisions. Among them, road conditions, temperatures, wind chill factors, and the forecast for what's to come later in the day. Each district makes its own independent decision. But, of course, even if schools decide to hold classes or delay them or end them early, the final decision rests with parents and guardians who may decide to keep their children home. Meanwhile, the community of Ziering had to deal with a water main break on Tuesday, one that affected service to residents. The break took place near the intersection of West Grant Street and South Central Street in Ziering, and water service was shut down to the town while crews worked to get repairs made. Classes were canceled at the elementary school because of the break. On the court beat, a registered sex offender was sentenced to 25 years in prison on Monday for sexually abusing multiple children at Hickory Grove Park near Colo. 30-year-old Michael Travis Ferguson had pleaded guilty last November to 5 counts of lascivious acts with a child. He had been arrested in October after police received reports of sexual abuse of children at Hickory Grove Park. One more note from Tuesday, a story about Ames 8th grader Grace McCann's philanthropic work, which has been made into a documentary that was chosen to show at the Omaha Film Festival. Grace has been raising money for Blank Children's Hospital for years, after she was a patient there suffering from chronic migraines. She said her observations of long-term patients at the hospital sparked the idea for her fundraising. She's raised more than $36,000 for the hospital, and she was honored last year as the Outstanding Youth in Philanthropy by the Central Iowa Association of Fundraising Professionals. Ames School District Communications Specialist Eric Schmidt created a documentary film about her, and that's the one that will be shown in Omaha. On Wednesday came word that the Ames School Board talked about changing next year's school calendar at its Monday night meeting. The board was presented with a proposal from 2 school principals to change next year's academic calendar to improve professional development for staff. The proposed change would replace 37 Wednesday morning sessions and become 3 early dismissals and 5 full days with professional development. The board will talk about this again at its next meeting on February 25th. Meanwhile, early voting for the March 5th special election in Roland began this past Tuesday, with voters being able to cast ballots at the Story County Auditor's Office in Nevada. On the ballot is a $3.1 million bond issue to build a new swimming pool and a race to fill a vacant seat on the Roland City Council. Also Wednesday, word that the Ames Fire Department will build a first-of-its-kind live training site in Ames this summer. It will be at Pullman Avenue and Carnegie Street on the city's east side and sit on a 90,000-square-foot plot owned by the city. The proposed training site will be made completely out of steel shipping containers, which can be assembled like Legos to create realistic components of a building. There was also a report that the Ames Animal Shelter has added new treatment services for adoptable animals, including microchipping and additional testing and vaccinations. Microchipping will now be provided for each adoptable dog, cat, and rabbit. Cats will receive rabies vaccinations and undergo testing for common feline viruses, while dogs will be tested for heartworms and also receive rabies and other vaccinations. Among the stories that came our way yesterday, Thursday, word that new parking hang tags are now being sold for downtown Ames parking. The city is providing hang tags that permit downtown district employees to park for more than 4 hours in any of the 4-hour free parking spaces behind Main Street. The monthly fee for the employee hang tags is $10. The minimum amount of time an employee parking tag may be issued is for 3 months. The tags cannot be used in the public library lot or in Campus Town. Downtown employees can buy a hang tag in the Public Works Engineering Department office on the second floor of City Hall. Also Thursday, word that the Ames City Council had made some minor changes to the current year's budget and to next year's proposed budget. If everything goes as planned, the property tax rate would go down 4 cents under next year's spending plan. Also yesterday, word that some Central Iowa school superintendents say the 2.3% hike in school funding approved by the State House and Senate is not enough to meet the needs the districts have. Almost $90 million in new K-12 money will be included in the new budget, increasing school spending to more than $3 billion for the next school year. Some superintendents say they will use the money to hike salary and benefits for staff. The Ames School District plans to use the new money to, among other things, lower class sizes and update curriculum. Thursday also brought the news that the Iowa State women's basketball team lost to TCU on Wednesday night, 76-69. And one more note from yesterday's paper, word that Iowa's Best Burger Contest is now underway. And you may recall that 2 of the past winners have come from right here in Ames. Brick City Grill won it in 2014, and Café Baudelaire won the contest last year. The winner of this year's Best Burger event will be announced May 1st. And there you have it, your summary of the past week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart. For some reason, giving this news summary has given me an appetite, so I think I'll grab a bite to eat, then take the weekend off. But I promise, I'll be right back here on Monday with a look at what's been making news all around Iowa. In the meantime, stay safe, stay warm, and have a great weekend.
Lunita by Dani Treubeg. And this is Local Talk. I'm Ursula Rudenberg. On Wednesday, February 13th, a Polk County jury delivered an historic win for transgender rights in Iowa. Melissa Hasso, American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa cooperating attorney, is with the Sherinian and Hasso Law Firm. I asked her to introduce herself, since she played a major role in this case, and to tell us what the win was and how they gained it.
I am a private practice attorney, and I was the cooperating attorney with the ACLU on the case. When the ACLU tries cases, they'll often associate with a practicing attorney, a trial attorney, to actually go to trial with them.
Tell us what happened.
Well, our client, Jesse Brew, was a nurse at the Iowa Correctional Institute for Women in Mitchellville, and he'd worked there for about 6 years, and he had gender dysphoria, and during his employment there, began transitioning into living fully as the male that he always knew that he was. And he was going through the transition under the supervision of his physicians, and it was a medically necessary transition. And he had already been transitioning socially outside of work, but he decided it was time to start transitioning inside of work also. And as part of that transition process, he needed to start living fully as a man at work, which included requesting to use the men's restrooms and locker rooms. Unfortunately, his employer refused to allow him to use the men's restrooms and locker rooms and instead decided he would be segregated into a separate unisex bathroom and not be allowed to use the men's facilities at all. And so that's what brought this lawsuit about in regards to the restroom and locker room use.
If you said it was a necessary surgery, what does that mean exactly?
It was medically necessary that he fully transition to live as a male. In other words, people with gender dysphoria, their sense of gender internally and psychologically is misaligned with their gender that's assigned at birth. And so that creates a lot of mental health issues. And so as part of the treatment for gender dysphoria, in many cases, the physicians will recommend that the person transition to fully living as the gender that they know themselves to be. Without a full transition, many transgender people will experience significant mental health issues that can even lead to risk of life and suicide. So that's why it's so medically necessary that people who are transgender in need of full transition are supported in that transition process.
And what does the term gender dysphoria mean?
Well, gender dysphoria is essentially a misalignment of who the person feels that they are in terms of gender as opposed to what they were assigned at birth. So, for instance, if somebody is born with female parts and they're raised as a female and they're told you need to wear the female clothes and do female things, that can create a lot of discord in them mentally if inside they know that they are male and vice versa. So that leads to a lot of depression, anxiety, other mental health issues until that condition is diagnosed and treated by qualified medical professionals.
Why is this ruling historic?
It's historic because we simply have not had transgender rights litigation in Iowa, and this is the first case that has gone to trial where the issue was whether or not a transgender person is entitled to use the restrooms and locker rooms and other single-sex facilities that's consistent with their gender identity. And that's what the jury found, was that our client, who is transgender male, was entitled to use the men's facilities, and that denying him the use of those facilities was discriminatory under the Iowa Civil Rights Act.
The Iowa Civil Rights Act was amended in 2007.
Right. The actual language in the act itself is gender identity. Of course, transgender rights incorporates gender identity. And the jury actually found it in our client's favor on both claims of sex discrimination and gender identity.
Sex discrimination was already there, but gender identity was new.
Gender identity was new to the act as of 2007, correct. Mm-hmm.
And so this was really the first test case in using this law.
As far as bathroom use, yes. There may have been various employment litigation, you know, whether it's settled or gone to trial in terms of discriminatory treatment at work. But this is a very specific issue in terms of the entitlement to use the single-sex facilities based on the gender identity of the individual at issue. And so that's what made this particular case so important. There was a second issue in the case as well. So Mr. Rue was a State of Iowa employee, and through his employment with the state, he was provided an employee health plan. And that particular plan had an exclusion written into it that specifically excluded gender reassignment surgery. And so this ties back into that concept of what people who are transgender need to fully treat their gender dysphoria. And many of those individuals need to have gender reassignment, or what we call gender-affirming surgery. And in Mr. Rue's case, he was seeking to have top surgery like a mastectomy. And under the policy, people who needed mastectomy for reasons other than to treat gender dysphoria were covered for that procedure. But Mr. Rue was denied benefits specifically because it was to treat gender dysphoria. And the jury also found that to be discriminatory under the Iowa Civil Rights Act.
You were successful on both counts. What is the result?
Mr. Rue actually left state employment in late 2016 and moved on to another employer, and he has been able to undergo the top surgery that he needed. So Mr. Rue is doing quite well, but one of the reasons he brought this lawsuit was not only to help himself, but help those that will follow him, because there are a lot of transgender Iowans that are going to face similar issues, and he wanted to make sure that this was brought to the forefront and that it was clear to employers what the law requires.
It was not an easy thing for him to do.
It has been a difficult road for him. It was a very brave thing for him to do, but we will also point out that his colleagues at the prison, not the administration that gave him the problems, but his colleagues were so supportive of him throughout the transition itself and throughout this litigation. And so we're very, very thankful to them and the support that they gave him. And we're also thankful to the jury in terms of being very open to understanding these issues and really grasping the nature of the discrimination at issue.
So in the end, there's really been a lot of validation for principal, but also the people involved.
Exactly. And that's just so important as we move forward on these issues.
What was the main defense of the, I guess we're talking about the Iowa Department of Corrections, is that right? They were the defendants?
That's right. On the bathroom use side, it was the Iowa Department of Corrections and the warden of the prison, who was Patty Wackendorf. And their defense was they were trying to balance Mr. Vrew's rights with the concerns of others. And the warden testified that she had received some complaints from other men who worked at the facility who did not want Mr. Vrew using the men's restrooms. She could name one of those complainants, and that complainant, the alleged complainant, testified under oath he never made that complaint. So the excuse that they presented at trial didn't bear out with the evidence. Not only that, even if people had complained, it's not a justification under Iowa law to discriminate against someone based on the concerns of others. And you can understand that by thinking about, you know, if somebody had issues working with somebody from a different race or a different gender, that's what the civil rights laws are designed to prevent, is discriminating against those people on those bases. So that's not a legal justification for discrimination. It's too bad if somebody else doesn't like somebody who is a different race or a different national origin or a different gender identity. They just need to deal with it because those people have rights under the law. Thankfully, in this case, that wasn't even the situation. Again, his colleagues were extremely supportive of him, both male and female. That was another very satisfying part of the case, is to see that kind of support for him. Now, what it requires.
And when in a lawsuit like this, is there compensation to the person suing, or what actually, other than having their rights reinstated, which in this case is really not an issue, are there other repercussions to employers when they lose a case like this?
Yes, definitely. The jury in this case did award Mr. Vrew $120,000 to compensate him for the emotional distress that the state's conduct caused him. So that definitely is a risk that employers face if and when they violate employees' rights under the Iowa Civil Rights Act.
Mm-hmm. Do you get the sense that it will be less likely that this type of discrimination will occur now that this precedent has been set by the court? Do these things tend to influence how employers behave?
We certainly hope that's the case. As I said, it's been the law since 2007, but as we repeatedly see with the state, they had not kept up to date with their training of staff, and they were not all aware that gender identity was a protected category here, you know, 10 years later or 11 years later. So we're hopeful that the publicity from this case will open the eyes of other employers so that they are aware of the issue and that they won't violate the law, either intentionally or unintentionally.
Now, this isn't protected in all states. So in what you're saying, I hear you saying that in this case, Iowa is on the right side of history.
Absolutely. And I really think that in 5 years, most people will look back and say, what was the big deal? You know, it will just be so accepted that gender identity is protected, and people hopefully will move past any kind of discriminatory instincts that they have and start treating people fairly and kindly, regardless of who they are.
So how does it feel to win a historic case?
It feels really good, but so important to be working on these cutting edge issues and moving the law forward. And we had 100% confidence that we were right and that the law would be on our side from the beginning. It was a long haul. It was 2 years of litigating it before we finally got in front of a jury. And we were confident the whole way through. It's just a matter of getting to that jury and getting the result that we knew we were entitled to. And so, of course, Mr. Vrew was just a hero throughout the whole process. And I'm just so honored to be able to work with my colleagues at the ACLU. They're brilliant. And without them and the support that the public gives the ACLU, we wouldn't be able to make these steps in furthering the civil rights of people who really need it.
Did you feel there was one argument that you made that was the most compelling or convincing to the jury?
I think the jury understood what Mr. Vrew had gone through. And certainly one of the ways we put this is, you know, if you don't let a transgender person use the restroom that conforms with their gender identity, it's no different than putting a sign on the restroom door that says, no transgender people allowed. And I think putting it in a very concrete way like that is something that people can understand, because in our history, we've dealt with that same issue in other categories of people who are protected under the law, whether it's race or gender or disability or anything like that. This is no different. And I think the jury really understood that.
So do you think their verdict reflects a changing views on these issues here in Iowa, or do you think it was just kind of a literal interpretation of what was already law?
No, I actually think this really was a symbol of the progress we're making in individual rights. And one of the clues I had to that, which surprised me, was in the jury selection process. You know, we have a pool of jurors from the Polk County area that we're questioning, and I asked a lot of questions about their knowledge of transgender issues. And I think out of the first 22 people I questioned, six of them had personal experience with either family members or friends or coworkers who were transgender. And so that really surprised me. I thought we'd have to start from scratch on these issues, but we didn't. They had extensive experience already, and they were very open about talking about their support for their friends and family members that had dealt with gender identity issues and who were transgender. And it was just such a joy to hear that people are already familiar with the issue and supportive of these people who otherwise are going through a very difficult time.
It's really interesting to hear.
Yeah, it was a surprise.
So there must have been some sort of celebration after this. What did Mr. Veru say to you about the victory?
He was just thrilled. He was thrilled.
Okay, thank you so much for your time. And that was Melissa Hasso, the American Civil Liberties Union cooperating attorney in this case with the Shrinian and Hasso Law Firm. And before we go any farther, I want to tell you about the squirrel real quick. The wild ones, the most recent wild animal that I connected with. Okay, I parked my car in the driveway outside my dad's house. It has to stay outside because his car stays inside. The place where I park is kind of next to a little concrete cliff. And on the other side of the cliff, there's trees, which are between us and the neighbor's house. I was having this really intense, you know, strategic conversation on the phone. So I just stayed in the car to continue talking. And, you know, to my left, on the other side of my window, which is closed, there's a tree. And it's, you know, maybe about 2 feet away from my shoulder, technically. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there talking. This squirrel, he climbs up the tree. He comes to my eye level next to the window. He's grabbing the tree by all four, hugging the tree so that he can make eye contact with me. And he starts staring me down. He's just like, so I'm like trying to have this conversation with my boss on the phone. And this squirrel has like planted himself right next to my head on the other side of the window. And he's like glaring at me. He's like trying to stare me down.
He didn't like what you were saying to your boss.
Anyway, that was my most recent. Now, we have a guest at our house. Her name is Utra. She's living there for a few weeks. And we have a bird feeder that hangs on the other side of the window from our sink. So Utra told me that there was a squirrel that was sitting. There's grapevine arbors by the windows, too, so animals can climb up there. She said there was a squirrel up there who was trying to get to the bird feed, but he couldn't. He couldn't figure it out. And so she said he kept coming to the window and making eye contact with her, like kind of saying, I need help here. You know, so I'm wondering if it's the same squirrel. So anyway, KHOI's reporter Joy B brought you some information about Ready to Run, which is a unique program in our area that opens up the world of politics and demystifies the process. For anyone who's interested in testing the water, it starts today. So Joy wanted to, she brought this up a few weeks ago, but she wanted to bring a little bit more information about it. So here's Joy introducing her guest.
Kelly Winfrey, the coordinator of research and outreach at the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University, directs a series of seminars called Ready to Run. These workshops are offered every other year. Kelly came by KHOI Monday to explain what Ready to Run is.
Ready to Run Iowa Campaign Training Program is a series of workshops that are designed to encourage women to run for office and to serve in public office, either an elected or appointed role.
Could you tell us about how long this has been going on at the Catt Center?
We've been doing this now for 12 years. We do it every other year during the spring semester. The Ready to Run program started at the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University, and they began taking on partners in 2007. And so we were one of the first partners.
What can you tell us about the seminars that are coming up?
So the way we have structured the workshop now is a series of 6 workshops on 3 different Fridays. So our first 2 workshops are this Friday, February 15th, and those workshops will focus on getting acquainted to Iowa politics and also launching a campaign. And then we'll have workshops in March and April. The March workshops will focus on fundraising and developing a campaign message, and the April 19th workshops will focus on communicating with voters in the media and campaigning online. We usually, the way it's structured, is a morning workshop from about 9 to noon. We have a lunch, and then from about 1:30 to 4:30, we have our second workshop.
Why would I, as a regular citizen and a woman, want to take, really, what benefits would it have for me?
It has a lot of benefits, and it can benefit women with varying interest in politics. The first couple workshops will focus a lot on understanding how politics, how campaigns, and getting appointed happens in Iowa. So, for example, we have a panel to discuss being appointed to boards and commissions at the state and local level, which is a relatively easy way with a low commitment to be involved in governing. We also talk about how to get involved in a political campaign. So even if you weren't someone who wants to run themselves but wants to become more involved with your party or with a candidate, workshops can help prepare you to do that. And so really, depending on what your level of interest is, the workshops will apply differently to you. And we try to bring in a lot of different speakers. So people who have ran for office, served on boards and commissions, people from the media, people that work on the campaign strategy side, to bring those different perspectives.
Could you tell us a few of those speakers that are coming?
Yeah. So for our first set of workshops on February 15th, we have Monique Bankin, who is a member of the Ames School Board and a former Ready to Run participant, Chris Corner, who is recently elected Iowa Senator. And she is also a former Ready to Run participant. And then I kept this panel all former Ready to Run. And Karen Derry, who was also just elected to the State House of Representatives. Melissa Giesing, who is the executive director of 50/50 in 2020, an organization that we work closely with because we have similar goals. And she'll be talking about researching and networking and building your social network to get more involved in politics. And then we also have Jesse Harris, who's a specialist in campaign strategy. And he'll kind of get into the nuts and bolts of how you build a plan for campaigning.
After I'm done with this program, what do you think I could do with it? How would I start?
One of the first things would be you could apply for a board or commission, whether that be at the municipal, county, or state level. And that's a relatively easy process to apply. You know, you can choose which boards would best fit with your availability and obligations. You could also be more involved in your political party, even if you're not running for office. So this can help you figure out ways that you can be more involved. And it can also start to prepare you for running for office. So even if you don't think, I'm going to run for office in the next year or two, it can help you start thinking about the groundwork that you need to lay, what types of offices might be the best fit for what your interests are and what issues you find important. Serving, running, just being a little bit more involved, there are takeaways for everyone. We still have some seats available for our February 15th workshop, and then we also have the upcoming workshops March 29th and April 19th, and the registration for those open 1 month prior. We post our schedules to speakers on our website if you want to have more information.
And is there any scholarships for maybe students that want to take this but maybe don't have the funds?
If students are interested, they should contact the CAT Center, so we'll try to work something out to get them sponsored.
And your website?
catcenter@iastate.edu.
So what inspires you about the work that you're doing with Ready to Run?
So my academic research is in women in political campaigns, and ultimately my goal with my research is to get more women elected to office and to have more equal representation. And the work I get to do with the CAT Center and Ready to Run specifically helps me take what I do in academic research and make it practical and actually try to make a difference. And we've seen women take the courses and be elected, have very positive experiences from that. And I think, you know, every year that I've done Ready to Run, I sit there during the workshops or I'm asking questions of panelists and I feel super inspired because there's just this energy in the room, and it's not partisan. It's just women supporting women and saying, yeah, we need to get into office. And I think that's kind of how inspiring that is, keeps me going. Even whenever gains can be slow, they're happening, and it drives me to do more.
So do you have anybody that led you to this career in women's studies, inspired you
Yeah, when I was in middle school, late elementary, middle school, was when Anita Hill hearings happened. As much as I didn't really understand everything that was happening with the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings, I knew something had happened to this woman and she was treated badly because she was a woman. Mm-hmm. And then also Bill Clinton was elected, which also brought lots of discussions about Hillary Clinton. We have lots of criticism of Hillary Clinton's haircut. She wasn't even the one running for office. And I remember having a conversation with my mom at the time about that. And she kind of said, well, Hillary Clinton doesn't act like people think first ladies are supposed to act. And I was kind of astounded, like, well, what does that even mean? I think that those two things happening at kind of a formative time in my life made me more interested in politics, particularly women in politics. And I would say both of them were in some ways role models, their strength and perseverance despite sexism.
What progress would you like to see in the future in regards to women?
There's a lot. I think in terms of getting more women elected, both parties could do more to recruit women within their ranks to run for higher office. And so that's one thing I'd really like to see. I'd also like to see us put more of an emphasis on getting even girls in elementary school more engaged in politics. There's a lot of research that indicates the difference in political ambition between men and women really starts to happen at a pretty young age, like around middle school and high school. The more we can make politics cool, politics something that is for everyone, the more we can start to get all sorts of people interested in earlier on. So I think that would help a lot to get more women involved if we started thinking about how do we engage girls and young women in elementary school and high school in politics.
Kelly Winfrey is the coordinator of research and outreach at the Carrie Chapman Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University, and she directs the Ready to Run seminar series starting today. Linda Merkin, Story County Supervisor, is a local resident who participated in Ready to Run and ended up running for office and winning. Here's what she had to say about her experience.
The first time that I participated in Ready to Run, I was very impressed by it. And the thing I found the interesting, that in 2017, they moved it twice as people were registering. They finally ended up in a very large conference room in one of our motels here in town because they kept getting more and more registrations. A huge group of people who just stepped up and said, it's time. I'm going to run for office.
Do you know what ignited that?
It was after the last presidential election. Just saw more folks getting involved and said, I want to be a part of this dialogue. I want to be a part of this decision making. You know, men also attend Ready to Run, but it's predominantly attended by women who are thinking about running. This is something people often say about Ready to Run, how men and women differ in terms of getting involved in politics. And what I've heard when I've attended Ready to Run is if you ask a man if he would be interested in running for an office, they'll kind of say, I could do that. You ask a woman, and it's, there's this kind of, I don't know that much about that. I don't have that much experience. Women tend to underrate and undervalue the experience they have and the knowledge that they have.
So when you took Ready to Run, what happened that made you want to take it several more times?
What was most useful to me was listening to candidates who had run and won. Some of them had run more than once. They did not win the first time. That, to me, turned out to be very important.
Oh, did that happen to you, Linda? Did you ever run and not win the first time?
I was asked to run, and I kind of put myself forward. It was a four-month campaign because I was nominated July 9th. The election was November 9th, and I lost by 864 votes out of about 46,000 cast. And I first thought, I don't think I'll do this again. Then the next day somebody said, that wasn't very many votes to lose by, you know. I said, well, I suppose. And I was asked if I'd run again. And I said I would think about it. And I thought about it for about 24 hours. And I said, yeah, I'm going to run. I enjoyed meeting people. I enjoyed campaigning. I enjoyed learning more about Story County. I did win in 2018. And I looked back at it. And having had that abbreviated campaign in 2016 taught me a whole lot. All the kind of things that Ready to Run can give a candidate a real jump start on. You end up working really hard, but you have a lot of fun. And that, I can't emphasize really how enjoyable I have found, you know, running for public office and being in public office. Another thing you learn at Ready to Run is that there are ways to get in to prepare yourself to be a candidate. After I retired from Community Corrections in 2010, I chaired our local fire agency board for a few years. I also served on the County Planning and Zoning Commission and also attended a lot of county supervisor meetings, sometimes as a league observer. I did have the experience of working with the League of Women Voters as a board member and president for about 5 years. And I really can't emphasize enough the boards and commissions, how important. There's city ones, there's county ones, some of the smaller towns also have boards of various kinds, and it's usually volunteer experience and not even a per diem paid, but it's a way to get involved in government. It's a way to see what is going on. And if people are interested in serving on boards and commissions, I would suggest that you look at the City of Ames website and the Story County website, and there's usually postings when there's an opening on a board and commission.
So as Linda Merkin pointed out, sitting on boards and commissions are important to us as well as running for offices. Iowa law actually requires gender balance. The Carrie Chapman Cat Center monitors this. I asked Kelly Winfrey about this.
Iowa law does require that boards and commissions be gender balanced. And one of the things we hear from boards of supervisors and mayors is that sometimes they have a hard time finding enough women to fill those boards and commissions. Certain boards might require there to be people with certain areas of expertise. Most of them are looking for citizens because it's a citizen government making decisions.
Is there any part of Iowa that really needs help in that area of gender balance?
What our research has shown is that it's not necessarily more populous or more rural areas. It's not more Republican or more Democrat. A few of the big things are efforts to recruit women and making the process transparent so that anyone who wants to apply can do it pretty easily. If you go to our website, the Cat Center, we have a lot of different reports at varying levels of office to see what those numbers look like. At the state legislative level, we'll have 45 women in the current legislature. That's up from 35 in the previous group. That's a huge improvement.
Do you think a lot of those new people are because of Ready to Run?
We just happen to have quite a few that were attended in 2017 that did run in 2018, including Cindy Axne, Deidre DeGier, Kara Derry, and several others. But I do think Ready to Run does a lot to prepare women. Research shows that women are far less likely to be asked to run by their friends and family, by government officials, by party leaders. So we try to really encourage that. And we also kind of demystify the process because a lot of our speakers are people who have ran, so it doesn't seem so difficult and so daunting.
All seminars are held on Fridays. The first seminar starts today. All seminars are held from 9 a.m. to noon to 4:30 with a break for lunch. The next seminars are March 29th and April 19th. Thank you for sharing this information with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me and for getting the word out about it.
Thank you, Joy B. Joy B is a KHOI reporter who does the Women's Beat. Alex Pfeiffer is here from the Ames Historical Society. Welcome back, Alex.
Hi, Ursula. Thank you.
Cold weather. Give a historical perspective to cold weather.
It's kind of been on everybody's mind recently, I think, hasn't it? It's hard to not be on your mind out there. We had that polar vortex that came through. Was that last week or the week before? Remind me.
Last week, right?
I think it was just last week. Yeah. And everyone was seeing, you know, negative 20s and wind chills of ungodly numbers below there.
Dry, cold air.
Dry, cold air.
Alex, we've had big storms before, right?
Oh, yeah. At least a good one every decade. There are ones that really stick in people's minds through years. I know there's a big one in 1936 that we had. You know, it was below zero for a month. We had 2 feet of snow on the ground. There was another really famous one in 1942. So Ames had, it was the New Year's Eve snowstorm. The reason this one became so famous is just because of timing. A Life magazine reporter was in town, and I'm not even sure what he was in town to cover, if he was just passing through and needed a place to stay, but he got trapped in the Shelton Mun. Naturally, like any good reporter, when a story comes to you, you take advantage. He went through downtown taking pictures of the snowstorm, of cars getting towed off of Main Street, and, you know, the amount of snow stacked on a bike rack and that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And Ames got a nice full 2-page spread in Life magazine because this reporter happened to be just stuck in town. It kind of a fun little story that has lived on through the years because of the fun Life magazine covered.
So you're in your exhibit at the Ames History Center right now. What is the exhibit called?
Exploring Unique photos of Ames. So these are highlighting photos that are from the Farwell T. Brown Photographic Archive. And that is, Farwell Brown was the founder of the Historical Society, and we collected all these photos. He did. Staff decided it would be fun if we picked our favorite ones, showing people a picture of either a location they are absolutely familiar with.
Well, you have some very spectacular photographs of winter fires.
Yes, we do, yes.
Which are very, very interesting photographs.
The armory, actually, it was built in 1920, but it actually burned down in 1922, just 2 years old.
Wow.
During the winter there. And
bummer.
I know, right? It's, luckily, they hung on to the building plans, and they were able to rebuild it. Almost exactly with the same building plans. So we have a nice photo of that, kind of explaining that. We also, but like I said, we also have some more recent fires that might be more in the community history. So it's a good blend of you know, things that happened around 1900 and earlier, and some things that happened more in the 70s, 80s that right. are more in the community
but
history.
But you don't have a picture of the Fiji fire.
The
in
Fiji
there.
Fire did not make that in there. That was not in Farwell Brown's photographic archives. So let's put ourselves in that situation with the same, pretty much the same climate, but you're fighting a fire. How would you like to do that? Well, the Ames PD back on January 15th, 1982, was fighting a fire at the Phi Gamma Delta House, better known as the Fiji Fraternity, on Ash Street and Knapp. Unfortunately, those guys had quite the fire to fight that day, with temperatures at negative 16. Their water and equipment was basically just freezing on site at the place there. So let's set it up a little bit, though. So the fire began with a day off of school, actually. Iowa State canceled because of the cold temperatures and didn't want to make people walk to class.
So this isn't the first time Iowa State's canceled because of cold.
No, yeah, we had that during the polar vortex, too. Yeah, it's kind of a rarity. And it's been probably about 5 years, I think, since the last closing day. So what do you do with a day off of school but sit around and play cards with your buddies?
Of course.
A couple of fraternity members were playing cards and decided it would be nice to have a fire going on cold day, which I would probably do, too, if I were them.
And they had a fireplace?
They had a fireplace, but unfortunately they didn't realize that their building, their fireplace was equipped with an ash dump. And so that was a way that you could drop the ashes down to a lower level for collection rather than having to scoop them out.
And this is under the fireplace?
Under the fireplace. And so the ash dump was there, and they didn't realize it was open.
Oh.
And so a hot ember log fell through the fraternity fireplace down into that lower level.
And they didn't notice it?
They didn't notice it until smoke started to come up through the floorboards underneath them when the lower room caught on fire. So traditionally it was used as a place to probably store extra wood and collect the ash and that kind of a thing down there. But as times change and we don't use the fireplaces for our main source of heating, they started using it as storage. So it was filled with all kinds of things that were highly combustible and just caught on fire. So the smoke is rising up out of it. They try to put it out themselves with hand extinguishers. The flames have just grown too much at that point. So the fire department comes and they start battling the thing. And it's quite the battle.
Now, what's interesting is that I don't live anywhere near there.
Yeah.
But somehow I was there. So that's it. I don't remember how that happened, but that says to me the word spread pretty fast.
Yeah.
That there was a really spectacular event happening over on Ash.
Yeah, and no social media to tell you. No text right away from a friend saying, get down here right away.
But there was a crowd, and I was in that crowd, and let me tell you, it was quite the show.
It was
amazing.
Those pictures are quite amazing if you haven't seen those. We just featured one in the newspaper last weekend, a photo or two of this fire to show you kind of what the building looked like. So if you have your Ames Tribune paper still around from last Sunday, grab that. But the place basically turned into like a, I like to call it a Jack Frost Winterland castle, essentially. I mean, just completely coated in ice.
Yeah. So you have to also know that the building itself was one of these very kind of Victorian, or I don't know if Victorian's the right word, but very kind of castle-like buildings to start with.
Very grand, yeah.
So it already looked like a castle.
It did, yeah. You just added the ice capade.
And then there was a layer of ice that was, and you could see the ice building as in real time, because as the fire hoses were, you know, hosing the building, the water was freezing.
Yeah, the spray was coming down and just freezing on everything.
So you were watching the ice build in front of you.
Yeah, literally right in front of you, kind of watching the ice cube form there. The fire department even had a fairly new ladder truck that they were using that day, and because of the freezing water getting blown everywhere, the nozzle froze, the ladder was frozen to the point where they couldn't retract it. All they could do was swing it from one way to the other. So they had to call for a reserve truck to come up and got that, and then they eventually had to even, with that truck, lower the ladder onto the building because they were afraid that all the weight that the ladder was taking on was going to tip the truck over, too.
Oh,
so
wow.
They were concerned with that, with it building. And, you know, hoses were freezing from what I hear from people. And they had to also, Rod Gibbs, who's still in town here, was a firefighter on duty then. He tells me they were, some parts they had to knock, chop through 3 feet of ice just to get hoses free at the end of the day. And some of the equipment they had to come back, after the weekend. This fire happened on a Friday, and on the Monday they came and picked up some of their equipment after it had gotten a little thawed.
And some people got hurt too, right? Some of the firemen.
Yeah, 6 firefighters were taken to Mary Greeley Hospital for treatment for effects of the weather. A couple had smoke inhalation. One was checked for frostbite, checked for hypothermia, and another one had re-injured some ribs on there. David Briley did. So, yeah, a few people set up, but could have been much worse, according to the paper, because the Farmhouse Fraternity, which a neighbor of theirs, set up an aid station. And so rather than the firefighters having to go and get out of the elements and go to the fire station on Welch, which wasn't too far away, but you got to think there's another person that's driving these people around. So it really helped to get everybody, keep everybody on site to keep battling that fire. So they were, people were going in and out of the farmhouse to get warm for a few minutes so they could go back out and fight kind of in shifts. And the
farmhouse was another fraternity right nearby, and it was kind of like this, it's kind of like a low brick, very modern looking building.
Like a 2-story building there.
Yeah.
And I think it's just, it's either one or two buildings north of the Fiji House.
Yeah,
they're within a half a block of each other.
It's another fraternity.
Very convenient. So they got all that set up, and Ralph Parks, the fire chief, was very thankful, and so were the firefighters. They said it would have been a lot harder to fight that fire without the help of the fraternity in the area, including the farmhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting. Like I said, I was there. I remember I was there with my mother and my siblings. You understood that this was a bad thing that was happening, and people were, the firemen were having a hard time working, and people, there was a danger, and obviously this building was not going to survive this.
Yeah.
But it was such a spectacular, show that it really could not be experienced as a tragedy at the moment, because it was this amazing visual event that just really captured everybody's imagination.
The beauty of the nature that's involved with it.
It was astonishing to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was just knocked out. I remember just like, wow, look at this, look at this. You know?
Well, some people must have been pretty interested, because there were quite a few reports of people walking through the frozen fraternity house trying to – some people were fraternity members that were trying to – gather up some of their belongings that may have survived, which is understandable. Other people were just curious bystanders like you who could not stop looking away. So the Ames police detectives were having quite a time making sure people weren't going back into the building there on Monday and collecting things and taking pictures and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I noticed the article you have there mentions that people were sneaking into the building. And
yes.
I got to admit, I was one of those people. It was amazing. The piano was encased.
Oh, my gosh.
In liquid glass.
Yeah.
Everything in the building was encased in ice.
Mm.
It's beautiful.
It's almost kind of a weird, eerie, serene feeling that I imagine. It's something like I think of when I think of like a piano that's in the Titanic down at the bottom of the ocean or something. I get
that same kind of
emotion that comes with that. I don't know what Farwell was up in 1982, but he didn't go take a picture of that one. He wasn't one of the people like you that got word out that to come down and see it. But
so everybody who has pictures of the Fiji fire, send them to the Ames History Center.
Yeah, come on down. Yeah, bring them. We do want... Yeah, you can email me, Alex at Ames History, and we can work that out. Please don't come in with photocopies of them, but we'll work out. We can get a good scan of your original. Yeah.
Okay.
Come down and visit us. Our hours are Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 4. And we're located at 416 Douglas, just one door north of the Pantorium, KHOI radio building.
And your website?
Is ameshistory.org.
Okay. Thank you, Alex Pfeiffer.
Thank you. Our exhibit up now is unique photos from the Farwell Brown Collection. You can visit us Tuesdays through Saturdays from 10 to 4 p.m.
Research and Exhibits Manager for the Ames History Center. And you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 5 p.m. on Fridays here on KHOI. And remember, you can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is also streaming live online at khoifm.org. KHOI.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Riches and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You also heard a recording by Danit Treubeg called Lunita. Remember, you the listener are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.